Lecture 10, Beliefs About the World and Other People.
Many psychologists make a sharp distinction between personality traits on one hand and beliefs on the other. But that distinction breaks down when people's beliefs lead them to behave in consistent, stable ways across many domains of their life. Certain beliefs cause people to have particular personality characteristics. Now, obviously, beliefs such as that George Washington was the first president of the United States, or that 2 + 2 = 4, don't have any implications for your personality. But when we think about big, broad beliefs that lead you to live in a particular way, those beliefs function much like personality traits. Many of the ways in which you differ from other people can be traced to differences in what you believe. What you believe about what other people are like, what you believe about how the world works, and what you believe about yourself. Consider your beliefs about human nature. In your view, are people basically good or basically bad? Are most people kind and helpful, or are they mostly self-centered and selfish? Are people mostly trustworthy and dependable, or untrustworthy and irresponsible? Of course, we all know that people vary a great deal. They aren't all the same. But each of us has assumptions about what people are like in general, what most people are like. When you're meeting someone for the first time, where do you implicitly assume that person falls on these various dimensions? What is your philosophy of human nature? It's important because your assumptions about human nature influence how you interact with people. For example, whether people have a generally positive or generally negative view of other people is related to how much they tend to trust other people. Quite reasonably, the more positively you view human nature, the more trusting you are. And the more positive people's views of human nature in general, the more positively they evaluate specific other people. For example, studies have shown that students' evaluations of their professors at the end of a course differ depending on the students' beliefs about human nature. Students who have more positive beliefs about human nature rate their professors more positively, as more knowledgeable and competent, as being a better teacher, and as having better relationships with students than students with less positive views of human nature. Our general assumptions about human beings color our judgments of specific people. And not surprisingly, people whose beliefs about human nature are more positive interact with other people in a more positive and open and agreeable way than people with generally negative views do. People who believe that human beings are generally altruistic and trustworthy treat other people differently than people with less favorable beliefs about human goodness. One study of elementary school teachers showed that teachers with more positive beliefs about human nature displayed more positive nonverbal behaviors when interacting with their students. They nonverbally conveyed that they were more approachable and interested in what students had to say. And their students reacted to these differences. Analyses of the students' behavior showed that students of teachers with more positive beliefs about human nature paid more attention in class and were more involved in class activities than students who had teachers with less positive views of human nature. People's assumptions about human nature bleed over into how they interpret the government's actions as well. People with more negative views of human nature impute more undesirable, diabolical motives to things the government does than people with positive views of human nature. Overall, there's no particular benefit associated with having consistently positive or consistently negative views of other people. People with either very positive or very negative views of human nature are more likely to misjudge people compared to those who don't show a bias in either direction and thus judge people more accurately. Yet many people do have a tendency to lean in a trusting or a cynical direction. You may have never thought about your philosophy of human nature, but it makes a difference in how you view other people and in the kinds of social interactions that you have, and it even affects how other people respond to you. The same is true of your beliefs about what the world is like. For example, is life fair? Do people usually get what they deserve, both good and bad? Of course, no one would say that all of life is fair, but in general, to what extent do you think that the world is mostly fair and just? Psychologists call this the belief in a just world, and the degree to which people believe in a just world functions like a personality trait. And like all traits, beliefs in a just world fall on a continuum. Almost nobody believes that the world is totally fair or totally unfair, but people differ a great deal in how fair they think things are. Perhaps most importantly, the degree to which people believe that the world is fair and just relates strongly to how they react to the inequalities that they see in the world. As we look around, we see that some people are well off financially and others live in poverty. Certain people are healthier than other people. Some people have greater access to education and opportunities to improve themselves than other people do. Some people have great jobs, and other people earn their living in awful ways. Disparities are everywhere. The question is, why do you think these inequalities exist? And are they unfair? Or are people mostly getting what they deserve? The more that people believe that the world is fair, the more they think that people are mostly responsible for the good and bad things that happen to them. One of the best replicated findings in this area is that people who believe in a just world think that people who are victims of misfortune are more responsible for their plight, whatever it might be. After all, if the world is a reasonably fair and just place, then if something bad happens to somebody, chances are that the person deserved it somehow. So people who think that the world is just are more likely to derogate and blame people for their personal misfortunes. For example, people who score higher in the belief in a just world are more likely to think that poor people are responsible for their plight, that people who get AIDS deserved it, and that the victims of sexual assault and other crimes probably did something to cause it, or at least they weren't careful enough. Healthcare providers who have a high belief in a just world are more likely to believe that patients are responsible for their medical problems. Of course, in some cases, people are responsible for the bad things that happen to them. So, researchers have designed controlled experimental studies in which it is clear that a person was not responsible for their misfortune. For example, in some studies, research participants watched another person supposedly receive painful electric shocks as part of a research procedure. Even though it should have been clear that the person was not responsible for being shocked, participants who believed more strongly in a just world were more likely to derogate the victim. The downside of believing in a just world is that it leads people to be less concerned about those who experience unfortunate circumstances. When bad things happen to other people, they assume that the person must be partly responsible somehow, so they don't feel as much empathy, and they aren't as likely to help. So people who believe in a just world are less inclined to support affirmative action and welfare and other programs that are aimed at helping people. People who believe in a just world also tend to have a stronger work ethic than people who don't believe in a just world. If you think that the world is unfair and that people don't get what they deserve, then there's no good reason for you to work particularly hard, because your extra effort won't pay off in the long run. Of course, many people work hard to reduce injustice in the world, which indicates that perceiving that the world is unfair doesn't necessarily lower how hard people work. People can certainly perceive that aspects of life are unjust while also believing that hard work pays off. We could argue all day about who's right and who's wrong, about how fair the world actually is. But regardless, your beliefs about this question affect how you respond to other people's misfortunes. Another belief that has received a good deal of attention involves something called locus of control. As they go through life, people want to understand the things that happen to them. Why are you and your romantic partner fighting more than usual? Why did you get the job instead of somebody else? Why did your car accident happen? Why did you not get the flu this year, even though the rest of your family did? The problem is that we almost never really know exactly why things happen as they do. Life is filled with attributional ambiguity. For most things that happen to us, there are too many possible causes to know for certain why something happened. I could have failed the test because I'm stupid, or because I didn't study enough, or because the teacher was unclear, or the test was unfair, or I was tired, or whatever. Maybe many things played a role. Who knows? But even though we rarely know for certain exactly why things happen, people gravitate towards certain kinds of explanations. Some people tend to believe that most of the things that happen to them are the result of their own behaviors, whereas other people tend to believe that most of what happens to them is the result of external influences of various kinds, things they can't control. This trait is known as locus of control. That's a strange name, locus of control, but it's shorthand for locus of control of reinforcement. In other words, where do you think the reinforcements and punishments that you encounter in life usually come from? If you generally assume that your outcomes in life are due primarily to your own actions, we say that you have an internal locus of control. If you think that your outcomes are usually the result of external influences, such as other people, situational influences, luck, fate, and other circumstances that are outside your control, we say that you have an external locus of control. So if I ask a student, why did you perform as you did on that test? A student who is high in internal locus of control would be likely to answer in terms of their ability or their effort, internal factors. But a student with an external locus of control would be more likely to point to some outside influence beyond their control, such as how hard or easy the test was, or good or bad luck, or the teacher, or other people who were helpful or distracting. Or if I asked you, why did you get sick? An internal locus of control person might say they got sick because of something that they did or didn't do. They didn't eat right. They didn't wash their hands. They didn't get a flu shot. A person with an external locus of control would probably say they got sick because somebody gave them a cold, or work really stressed them out lately, or it was just bad luck. Get the idea? Whether people use primarily internal or external explanations for things that happen to them has a number of implications. For starters, the higher people are in internal locus of control, the more information they seek during the course of everyday life. For example, when people have a medical condition, patients who are higher in internal locus of control take it upon themselves to get more information about their problem and its treatment. Likewise, students who are high in internal locus of control work harder to understand the requirements and regulations at their college. And research shows that prisoners who are higher in locus of control learn more about the policies at whatever jail or prison they're in. And it's clear why. If you think that your outcomes in life depend on what you do, then it makes sense to get as much information as possible to help you make good decisions, whether it's about your health or your education or your incarceration. But if you have an external locus of control, there's no good reason to know very much about what's going on, because you don't think you can do anything about it anyway. Whatever happens is outside your control. People high in internal locus of control are also more likely to take action to improve their lot in life. Since they think that their actions affect their outcomes, They put more effort into doing what they think is needed. And because they take action, they're more likely to achieve those desired outcomes than people with an external locus of control. So students who are high in internal locus of control are more likely to do well in school. And employees who are high in internal locus of control are more likely to succeed at work. Even among less intelligent students and less skilled employees, internal locus of control is associated with better performance. In the same way, internal locus of control is associated with better health. People who think that their actions affect their outcomes take better care of themselves, and they're more likely to take action when they're sick. Not surprisingly, people with an internal locus of control are, on average, healthier than people with an external locus of control. There's a large research literature just on locus of control as it relates to health. One of the most widely studied effects of locus of control involves psychological well-being. People who have an internal locus of control are, on average, happier and better adjusted than people who have an external locus of control. They tend to be less anxious. They feel less hopeless and pessimistic. And they're less likely to be depressed. And perhaps most strikingly, they're also less likely to try to commit suicide. These effects reflect the fact that feeling that you don't have much control over your life is exceptionally distressing. When people don't think they have much control over the things that happen to them, they feel powerless and at the mercy of external influences. People with an external locus of control walk through life believing that most of what happens to them just happens without much input on their part, so they're more likely to be anxious and unhappy. Well, where do locus of control beliefs come from? Why do some people believe that they have more control over their life than other people do? Researchers have studied this question by measuring children's locus of control beliefs and then looking at their parents to see if any particular parenting styles are associated with internal versus external locus of control. And the findings are pretty clear. Parents of children with an internal locus of control tend to be more responsive and supportive. And parents of kids with an external locus of control tend to be more controlling and domineering. When parents are responsive to their kids' preferences, needs, and even objections to what the parent says, children learn that they can do things that affect their outcomes. Children see that they can affect what happens to them, at least within limits. But when parents are less responsive and more controlling, children learn at an early age that they don't have much control over what happens. Other people call the shots, and there's nothing much they can do to change things. So they develop a general sense that they don't have much control over their outcomes and develop an external locus of control. Of course, other factors undoubtedly play a role in the development of locus of control, such as people's culture, their religious beliefs, and personal experiences. But we know less about those causes. I'm going to wind up this lecture with a look at the trait of authoritarianism, which, at its core, involves a particular set of beliefs and attitudes. Now, in everyday language, people sometimes use the word authoritarian to refer to people who are domineering and strict, or who emphasize absolute obedience to authority, like a harsh authoritarian parent or a strongman sort of dictator. That's not quite what the authoritarian personality involves, although there is a connection. As a personality characteristic, authoritarianism involves a set or syndrome of attributes, none of which by itself would be considered authoritarianism. As I'll explain in a moment, the three primary characteristics of the authoritarian personality are rigid adherence to traditional attitudes and values, prejudice toward a broad assortment of groups, and a preference for strong political leaders who will crack down on people who don't conform to one's own traditional attitudes and values. In early research on prejudice, during the first half of the 20th century, psychologists discovered that people who are highly prejudiced usually don't dislike just one group. You might think that people would dislike some specific group for some specific reason, but think that everybody else is basically okay. But that's not what researchers found. Instead, they found that prejudiced people are often prejudiced toward many groups. For example, they might not like certain people because of their race, and they don't like other people because they practice certain religions, and they don't like other people because of their sexual orientation. This discovery revealed a personality trait that involved a broad pattern of prejudice and ethnocentrism. And over time, research on this trait expanded to what became known as the authoritarian personality. Research on the authoritarian personality really took off after World War II, as researchers tried to understand what had happened in Nazi Germany. And since then, hundreds of studies have examined the nature and the causes of authoritarianism. After all that work, disagreements still remain about the key features of the authoritarian personality. But the three characteristics I mentioned earlier figure into most descriptions of authoritarianism, so we'll focus on those three. The characteristic that seems most central to authoritarianism involves rigid adherence to conventional, mainline, usually middle-class attitudes and values. People who score high in authoritarianism believe that their own conventional beliefs, values, and lifestyles are the only right ones, and that people who don't share their cultural beliefs and values and who don't live like they do are wrong, if not somehow evil. This firm commitment to one's beliefs shows up in a number of ways. For example, authoritarianism correlates very highly with believing that one's own religious views are absolutely correct and that everybody else is completely wrong. So people who score higher in authoritarianism tend to populate the most fundamentalist segments of every religion. Not only fundamentalist Christianity, but also fundamentalist subgroups of Judaism and Islam, compared to Christians, Jews, and Muslims, who subscribe to less fundamentalist beliefs. Authoritarianism is also associated with fervent patriotism, the kind of patriotism that recoils at any suggestion that one's own country isn't the best in the world. Authoritarians tend not to tolerate any criticisms of their country, and they're the sort who tell people who complain about the country that maybe they should just move somewhere else if they don't like it. People high in authoritarianism also tend to endorse more traditional sex roles. For example, people who score higher in authoritarianism are more likely to say that they like being a traditional male or female. Authoritarian men and women also support more traditional roles for men and women. One manifestation of this belief is that the higher a college woman scores in authoritarianism, the less likely she is to seek an advanced degree. Authoritarianism is also related to the characteristics that heterosexual men and women find attractive in members of the other sex. Authoritarian women are more attracted to conventionally masculine men, and authoritarian men are more attracted to conventionally feminine women. Given what I've said so far, you probably won't be surprised that authoritarianism correlates with conservative values in general. For example, in the United States, authoritarianism is associated with less concern with environmental issues, with a desire for fewer restrictions on gun ownership, with pro-life attitudes toward abortion, and with negative attitudes toward feminism. I'm not making a political statement here, and I'm not saying that all conservatives are authoritarian. I'm just noting that traditional values are associated with conservative political attitudes. Of course, we all have values that are important to us, And most of us wish that other people would see things the way that we do. But people who are high in authoritarianism have particularly negative views of people who don't share their values. This is the prejudiced component of authoritarianism. People who score high in authoritarianism tend to be prejudiced toward a broad range of racial and ethnic groups, as well as toward atheists, members of non-mainstream religions, homosexuals, drug dealers, homeless people, and people with liberal attitudes. The common theme here is a distrust and dislike of people who don't share their cultural attitudes and values. This component of authoritarianism is sometimes called authoritarian aggression, but that's not a very accurate label. A better term might be something like authoritarian rejection, because it involves devaluing, condemning, rejecting, and sometimes punishing people who don't share one's values. Aggression isn't necessarily involved, although it can be, as in cases when people attack a gay person or a member of another race simply because they are a member of another group. The third primary component of authoritarianism involves a preference for strong political leaders, particularly leaders who will crack down on all those people who are violating the person's values. People with an authoritarian personality would like the government to impose their views and values on everybody, and they even support the use of illegal tactics by the government to crack down on these groups. In fact, people higher in authoritarianism are less concerned about human rights than people low in authoritarianism when the people whose rights are being violated are members of distrusted and disliked groups who don't share their values. So, where does authoritarianism come from? What leads people to be so invested in their own beliefs and in their own groups that they're prejudiced toward those who think differently and seek strong leaders who will enforce their views? We know that more authoritarian parents tend to have more authoritarian kids. And early on, research pointed to strict discipline and harsh parenting as a contributor to authoritarianism. But researchers have struggled to separate various kinds of parental influences. The problem is that if a child with authoritarian parents has a greater likelihood of also being high in authoritarianism, at least three different things might be going on. First, studies of the heritability of authoritarianism agree that somewhere between 40% and 60% of the variability that we see in the attitudes that characterize authoritarianism can be traced to genetic factors. We don't know what aspects of the brain are involved, but we know that genes play a role. Second, certain parenting practices, such as being exceptionally strict, do seem to result in greater authoritarianism in children. Strict rules and harsh punishment teach children that it's very important to behave in particular, circumscribed ways, and that it's okay to punish people who don't have the right views or behave the way we'd like them to. And third, authoritarian parents role model authoritarian attitudes and behaviors. When mom and dad demonstrate prejudiced attitudes or derogate members of certain groups, the kid starts to adopt an authoritarian perspective, just like any other attitudes children might pick up from their parents. So we know that something is going on with parents, but we're not entirely sure what. It's likely that all three of these influences occur. There's also evidence that some people pick up authoritarian perspectives from their peer groups during adolescence. We all get many of our values from our peers. So if a kid ends up with a bunch of authoritarian friends, it wouldn't be surprising that some of it would rub off. Interestingly, though, going to college seems to reduce authoritarianism on average, particularly for students who score very high in authoritarianism at the time they start college. These effects are strongest for students who attend liberal arts programs, which seem to challenge many of the beliefs and attitudes that maintain authoritarianism. Research also suggests that the authoritarian personality is fueled by uncertainty and anxiety. If we ask the question, why is it so important for some people to think that everyone should follow their cultural values and rules? One answer is that the world seems a lot safer if everybody sees the world the way that I do. And so people with different religious beliefs, values, and lifestyles can threaten people's sense of security. Along these lines, people who are high in authoritarianism tend to perceive their social environments as more threatening and dangerous. And authoritarian attitudes increase, even among people who are not authoritarian, in the face of social and economic threats. When crime is rising, or the economy is bad, or the country is experiencing a political crisis, authoritarian tendencies increase. The overriding theme of this lecture has been that you are who you are, partly because of the beliefs that you hold. If you believed other things, you'd be a somewhat different person with a somewhat different personality. There's an important implication of that fact that's worth considering. One important way of changing people's personalities is to change what they think.